To see examples of what we talk about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
I bought the Kiss bubblegum cards. You know,
you did buy the Kiss bubblegum cards, didn't you?
I still got them.
You still do? A complete set?
Nah, but I got a stack of them.
Yeah, you never bought the records.
I've got two records. I don't know if I still have them. My uncle, for Christmas, gave me Kiss Alive 2, which is a double album. Really awesome cover. It has that booklet inside it, you know, from every year that they change their costumes.
Yeah, right.
I listened to it a lot. And then a friend of mine gave me their disco album they did called Dynasty.
The whole thing's disco?
It's not really a disco album, but they put it out in 79. And they had that song, I Was Made for Loving You.
Oh, yeah, that was a disco song, yeah.
But I liked that song. It was pretty good. And it has Ace Frehley sings 2000 Man. It says it was written by Keith Richards and Mick Jagger.
Oh, they do a Stones cover. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and those to me are the two songs to listen to. The rest of it's kind of
like lame.
But a friend of mine bought it and didn't like it and gave it to me.
You still have it on vinyl?
I'm not sure if I still have that one. That one I might have parted ways with, but I don't know. I might have it.
Oh, by the way, I'm recording, so this is Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. I'm Al, and you are?
Don, talking about a band I didn't particularly care for.
And we're talking about comic books now. No more band talk. We're talking about funny books. So, have you gone to see that new Batman, Superman? Are you going to go see it this weekend?
No, I haven't seen it, nor am I going to.
You're not interested?
I'm just not interested. As a matter of fact, Dallas has carried on with great excitement about Man of Steel, you know, the Superman movie. And a friend of mine at work is constantly getting on to me about not going to see any of these because he doesn't read comic books, but he goes to see all the movies. And there's a whole circle of these guys that get on to me. I don't mind if people go see it. It's not a great hate or anything. I'm just not interested. But anyway, Thursday night, I was just flipping channels, and FX said, coming up, you know, Man of Steel. All right, I'll watch it. I watched it, and I kept thinking, man, this movie's long. And when the credits were rolling, by this time my wife came in, and she watched it with me. I was glad when it was over.
Really didn't like it at all, huh?
Well, no, not really. They did some things that were neat, and I appreciate that they were changing it up. You know, I could see where I think Zack Snyder did that movie. He's the one that did Watchmen. I think he did 300.
I think he did this one, too.
But I've just never really liked his movies. He gives it, in Watchmen, he gave the movie the look of the comic, and that's why I wanted to go see it. I liked the Watchmen comic, and it looked neat. But seeing it, it's just like it's, in my opinion, it was just a lot of superficiality. There was no poetry to it. There's no thinking. It was just, you got the surface level stuff, and that was it. In Man of Steel, the effects were really something. And, you know, showing buildings getting smashed by Superman and Zod. There were neat things that they did in it. And, I mean, it was convincing. Sometimes a little too convincing because I found myself a little upset that they were destroying Metropolis so bad and all these people were in great danger. But, you know, there was another kid in Smallville, well, a whole bus full of kids that found out that Clark was really super, you know, and then he disappeared. I like stuff like that. That was kind of interesting. It didn't follow the tropes of the comic all of our lives. So they took chances, and I respect it, but a lot of people love that movie, and that's fine. You know, there's a lot of movies I love that people have no interest in. And but no, I didn't enjoy watching it for free on TV. And I'm tired of Superman and Batman fighting all the time. It was awesome in Dark Knight. I mean, that one was just awesome. I'd never seen it before. You know, in Dharma Cook's New Frontier, which is a series I loved, they alluded to it, and then when I guess the New Frontier came out on they made the animated film, which was I really liked. Dharma Cook did another issue of New Frontier, and it told the backstory of that actual fight between Superman and Batman, and Wonder Woman stepped in. Well, it was neat, you know. But I don't know. They're always fighting. I'm sorry, Batman's awesome, but he's not going to be Superman. I don't know. It's just, I'm tired of it.
Well, it seems like my friend saw it, and he described it to me yesterday. It seems like they're turning Batman into, like, Iron Man, because it's like, his costume now is almost invincible and vulnerable and all this stuff that he's got. So they're kind of like, you know, mutating these things. And that's why I don't go to see the movies, because they're getting so far away from what I remembered as being the ideal of the character, that it's just kind of like, okay, you know, they're big money makers. People like to see them. They're special effects. Apparently, this one follows the Doomsday story, so you know where that goes. So not to give anything away, I should have said spoiler alert, but...
You know. It's not. We haven't seen the movie, so even though you're saying you heard this and that...
By the time the show plays, people who wanted to see this movie already saw the movie. So.
Well, I think they were showing Doomsday in things online for a long time, because I'd heard that he was in it.
Yeah.
So that's not really a surprise. But I don't know. If you're interested in seeing it, go see it. Have fun. If you're not, well, that's okay too.
I mean, do you in general go see the superhero movies?
No.
No, you don't?
No, I've never really liked superhero movies. I like Superman too. And I love Rocketeer. Yeah, I really love that one. I did see that at the theater. I heard it was good, and it was good. I enjoyed it. The only other movie I saw at the theater was Ant-Man. I just thought
it looked... You did like that one, though.
Yeah, it looked fun. The commercials looked fun, and I always liked Ant-Man. And my wife, we were talking about going to movies, what do you want to see? And I said, Ant-Man. She goes, oh, yeah. You know, she was interested in it. We went. It was fun. I really liked it. I bought Iron Man. I wanted to see it at the theater. My wife just looked at me like she had no interest. I couldn't even get my daughter to see it. She said, I don't like superhero movies.
Wow.
And when the DVD came out, I bought it. I liked it. My daughter ended up loving it. I think my daughter, with boyfriends, has seen every Marvel movie that's come out. But
well, you liked Iron Man.
Yeah, I did like Iron Man, and I liked Ant-Man, which I, you know, talking about it, I guess they just kind of redid Iron Man and Ant-Man, but it was different enough, and, you know, it was fun. But as my wife always said, she doesn't like to go see movies on movies based on books I read or comic books I read, because all I do is complain, and I have to admit that's true. Although, I am excited about Valerian. You know, Luc Besson, who did Fifth Element, is working on Valerian, and I'll tell you, I'm like a little kid.
I've never seen that movie.
Yeah, we talked about it, and that's okay, man.
I wanted to get a reaction out of you.
I was shocked when you told me, because that was when you were still going to the movie theater, you know?
Was it that long ago when that movie
came
out?
Yeah, the movie was out in 97.
I still was going to the movie theaters, yeah. I'm surprised I never did see it.
You know, I just found out that Mobius sued Luc Besson over Fifth Element. He worked. He was one
of... Why, he didn't get credit on it?
Oh, no, he did. Him and J.C. Mazieres, the movie was made for them. And Luc Besson had talked to both Mazieres and Mobius and said, you two have either worked on all the biggest, you know, science fiction movies, or you've influenced all the biggest science fiction movies. He says, but yet, neither one of you have ever really had your own. So he proposed to them of them making a movie together. And both of them said, but of course. And Luc Besson wrote The Fifth Element. And when I saw it, I thought, you know, this really goes along with the Inkle. I mean, closely. It's kind of like they made a movie version of the Inkle, but they just changed the characters and a lot of settings and stuff. I mean, it wasn't, you know. But I was just reading about it that there was a lawsuit. Mobius sued, you know, Luc Besson.
Do you know what the reason was?
Because it was too close to the Inkle.
Even though he worked on the movie, he didn't realize it while he was making it.
He didn't win. I mean, it went away. Okay. But now, I don't know the whole story. I just read about... He sued, but
he probably worked on it and didn't know where the story was going, and he went, you know.
Well, Luc Besson, he got both J.C. Mezières and Mobius were credited as production designers.
Yeah.
But on the Fifth Element Expanded Edition DVD that I've got, they interviewed, and Luc Besson said that, you know, he was a huge Mobius fan, he was a huge J.C. Mezières fan, had all their comics, and I guess he grew up on a farm in France. And he says all he had was imagination. They didn't have a TV in the house. So, you know, he'd get the comics and read those. And he said the credit they got in the movie was production designers. This is, but they went far beyond that. I mean, basically, they developed everything with him. And you could see it. Watching it, it was very faithful. That movie's on so many levels. There was a character in the film that was the bad guy's assistant. I can't remember the name of that protagonist. But he was in occasional trouble, and he always had this silent assistant with him. And the music was real industrial, techno-industrial kind of. It went with the movie. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine bought the soundtrack to it. He liked it so much. But I found out that bad guy's assistant was the musician that did the music. He's called Tricky. He's in France.
Oh, I remember that guy from a while back ago, yeah.
Well, he was in a Maggie Cheung film, the last movie she made. Maggie Cheung she played Jackie Chan's girlfriend.
Wasn't
in the police
store.
He was
a musician? He was an actor, too?
Yeah, well, in this movie called Clean with Maggie, her husband dies of a drug overdose. He's a musician. And anyway, at one point, Nick Nolte was Maggie Cheung's father-in-law, and he has these, I guess they were going to re-release his dead son's music, and he told his wife, he says, these are done by his friend Tricky, and but there was artwork of, you know, the son, you know, for three new albums, and he said they were going to re-release them. And I just remember that Tricky, and at one point Maggie Cheung sees him, is calling out to him, Tricky, and he just ignores her. Well, that's the guy. Well, he is a real person and a real musician. Mm-hmm. But he did the soundtrack to The Fifth Element. To me, The Fifth Element was one of my favorite movies. When it's on TV, I have the DVD. I bought it twice. I bought the original DVD. When it came out as expanded edition, I bought it again. And my daughter's like, how many copies do you need? I had it on VHS. And when it comes on TV, I stop what I'm doing and I'm watching it. It's just absolutely one of my favorite movies. It's like a giant roller coaster of everything I love, you know. But, nevertheless, if you don't like it, that's fine. Or if you had no interest, that's fine. I was teasing you the other day. I was shocked, but you know, it's, you know.
Well, I felt hurt. Hey. I'm such a sensitive guy.
Yeah. That's what Dan Pritchard said to me. He's talking about the last episode. I think those guys will hurt on you. And I was laughing about it. He says, I know you're sensitive. I says, I hope nobody noticed.
Yeah, it's funny because I saw some. I was going to the movies during that time, and I never did get around to seeing that. I guess it must have been like didn't play long in the theaters, or I mean, I don't know.
No, it played long, and it
was a hit.
Oh yeah, it was real successful.
Okay.
And I've heard
maybe it was just like I don't want to see another Bruce Willis movie.
I don't know why everybody says that. I always give him a slide. I like Bruce. But, you know, whenever I see Bruce Willis, I always think of Moonlighting. I think that's the guy from Moonlighting.
Smarmy. You know,
I love that show. Moonlighting, okay. If you're too young, Moonlighting was a TV show on ABC in the mid-80s. And it was basically, Bruce Willis, who had hair at the time, and Sybil Shepherd, who was a model actress.
She had hair, too.
Yeah. But, I just got out of the Navy. I hadn't seen TV in years and years. I didn't get to watch TV when I was in college. I didn't watch it when I was in the Navy. And when I got out, I was looking at all these TV sitcoms and dramas and stuff. It was just garbage. But there's nothing else to do in L.A. at the time. I had no money. And I'm getting ready to go to the laundromat. The TV's on and Moonlighting comes on. I said, oh, God, it's one of these shows. And I'm packing up the laundry basket, you know, and I'm getting ready to go across the street. And all of a sudden, Bruce Willis is in his office watching a little black and white TV, and the original King Kong is on. And he said, oh, Kong, don't fall for her. It's no good. You're going to come out losing. Don't fall for her. You know. And he just keeps saying this, and it was funny. And then Sybil Shepherd burst in, and the dialogue just sucked me in. I didn't watch that night. I just stayed there and watched the show. And I didn't miss it after that. It had great writing, great dialogue, but the whole idea of the show was Sybil Shepherd was a big fashion, high-end fashion model, as she was in real life. And she invested all of her money because of her manager. And then kind of find out her manager swindled her. She lost everything, was broke. He took off with everything. And everything he did, he invested into a detective agency. And when he took off, he left that because there was a bunch of bogus things he had. Well, that's the only thing she had left. So she showed up at the office, and basically the detective agency was Bruce Willis. Had a bunch of people that worked for him that played cards and shoot craps all day. And she shows up, and all of a sudden they actually have to start taking cases. It was funny. And it lasted a while. My wife and I always watched it. And I remember he did, he started doing movies. He even had a record album.
Yeah, you know? He did. Yeah, sure.
And but he did a movie called Blind Date with Kim Basinger. Blake Edwards was the guy that did it. And I thought, he's just going to be a funny comedian. And the movie was so-so.
Pulp Fiction.
Well, what happened was he did Die Hard. And
yeah,
nobody could see Bruce Willis did an action movie because you still thought him was the funny guy in Moonlighting,
yeah.
The funny R&B guy.
Yeah.
And then Die Hard got to be huge, and after that, like I said, Pulp Fiction, you name it, he was in it.
12 Monkeys, which I talked about before.
Yeah.
And,
well, he was in every... when Rook was talking about that comic book, Replicants, I think it was
yeah.
the name of it, Bruce Willis was in that. He was in a movie, and it was good.
And Sybil Shepherd kind of just went away.
Well, she had a hit sitcom for a long time.
Did she? She had another one?
Yeah, called Sybil on CBS. It lasted for years.
I think that show worked, but there was problems on the... There was tension on the sex. I think both of them had, like, you know, the A personalities or whatever, you know. But I saw a couple of episodes. They were okay. I mean,
it went downhill. I mean, the first season was really something special. As it went on, they started kind of developing some of the secondary characters, and it had its moments, but it was... You could see that the best time was behind them. But anyway.
What about... Okay, well, let me ask you another question about a TV show, since we're talking anything but comics, right? Well, no, we talked about comic book movies. I take that back. What about X-Files? Were you an X-Files guy?
Yeah, not from the beginning. Did you watch it?
I saw it a couple of times. I didn't, you know...
Yeah, people at work were carrying on about it. We didn't watch it because my daughter was small and, you know...
Scary.
At one point, people kept saying they love the X-Files and you should watch it. But by that time, so many, you know, I wasn't aware of it. And when I was, I just, you know how when you don't catch it from the beginning, you think, why get into it?
Yeah.
Well, then one night, Sunday night, my wife and I saw one and I liked it. She loved it too. And then I can't remember at one point, she said, are you going to watch the X-Files? Oh, yeah. And we did the last few seasons, and people at the karate school started lending me their VHS tapes of it. The early seasons were really great. And then it went off from there. But yeah, I mean, I watched it, not as religiously as some other people, but I liked it. And then
yeah.
they just brought it back on TV for
they
six episodes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I watched them. And there was one episode about a horned toad. I thought it was awesome.
Oh, okay.
It was neat. Towards the end, sometimes I think they were, I don't know.
Kind of went on too long, maybe?
Well, I think the earlier shows were pretty imaginative, and they had a sense of humor. And it seemed like to me when the season went on, it was too much about the two main protagonists and their relationship. And, you know, when TV shows go on, after a while it stops being about the story and about the two main characters and their relationship.
They run out of ideas.
But then every once in a while there's some flash of brilliance, and you think, okay. And when they brought those six episodes back, I was surprised. It was great fun. I enjoyed it. So
okay, sounds good.
But,
all right, let's just take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to actually talk about real life comic books on paper and that you read and all that kind of stuff.
Guten Tag, meine Damen und Herren. Sie hören eine Sonderdurchsage der Polizei. Das Bundeskriminalamt gibt Ihnen Gelegenheit, Gespräche der an den Morden in Köln und der Entführung des Dr. Schleyer beteiligten Terroristen zu hören und bittet um Ihre Unterstützung. Hören Sie sich bitte die jetzt folgenden Stimmen in Ruhe an und achten Sie besonders auf die Eigenarten des Tonfalls, der Ausdrucksweise und der Sprachfärbung. Aufzeichnung 1.
Was ist jetzt möchte ihm vielleicht etwas ausrichten. Ich möchte ihm gerne eine Mitteilung des Kommandos X tauschen, aber ich werde in ungefähr einer Stunde nochmal an. Ich bedanke mich.
Aufzeichnung 2.
Die Regierung ist heute Morgen erst bei Johann gegangen und hat folgenden Wortlaut. Er wird ihn doch schon nicht zu kennen.
Aufzeichnung 3.
Hallo, wer spricht das bitte? Meier, wir sind leider eben unterbrochen worden. Sie hatten den Text jetzt richtig. Und das werden Sie zur gegebenen Zeit erfahren. Das Ganze ist unterschrieben mit Kommando 6000 und kriegt dann 12.1977. Dazu ist dann noch eine Bemerkung zu machen. Das wäre für Sie sicher interessant. Und das wäre dann auch alles. Danke.
Aufzeichnung 4.
See, this is so uncomfortable.
Yeah, I didn't realize it. Guess I might as well do my makeup. In case we get out of this thing, I want to put good pictures. It's my only claim to fame thus far.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Okay, we're back. That was Brian Eno, a B-side of Kingsland Hat. That's a song called RAF. It's credited to Brian Eno and Snatch. So I guess Snatch is the band. I don't know. But anyway.
Man, he gets around.
That was from 1977, though. So
yeah. Brian Eno was well, I always knew him as a keyboardist, but he was
for Roxy Music, yeah.
Yeah, and he producer. Played. Oh, I didn't know. For Roxy
those
Music.
Three. He produced those Bowie albums that are great.
Oh yeah, well, I knew he became a producer. Yeah, he. I always knew him as an ambient musician that worked with David Bowie sometimes.
Right.
I had a professor in college, an art professor, and he used to bring in tapes of Brian Eno, Another Green World. Brian
I like
Eno.
That record.
Yeah, I did too. Music for Airports.
That one I didn't listen to that much.
You know, it was a funny story. There was an organization called the Long Now Foundation, and it's about long-term thinking, and I guess he was somehow one of the founders to this. But they always have somebody come on, microbiologist, geneticist, you know, engineers, scientists, and they come on and give a talk about society and thinking long-term, you know, solutions. And Brian Eno did one, and he was talking about, he was in at the airport in Berlin, which must be a really impressive airport, but he says the piped-in music they play throughout the airport, he says, he was listening to it while he's waiting, thinking, the only reason you're playing this music is just to convince you that you're not going to die. And it's trying to convince you. And he said, to him, that made it worse. And that's why he did the album, Music for Airports. It says that was his idea for what an airport could play music for that would be incidental and, you know, I don't know. I don't really find that positive to convince me I'm not going to die, but I do like it. But... And he played with David Bowie. I've heard him play
Roxy Music.
Yeah, Roxy Music. And there was other musicians. Well, I think he did some music with Robert Fripp.
Oh, those two albums, yeah. The Evening Star and Oh, what was the first one? The famous one. Yeah, he did records with Robert Fripp. He played with John Cale.
Well, he was with Talking Heads. He produced or did stuff. Yeah,
No Pussyfooting was the Robert Fripp and Eno.
But, I mean, he was around. And then U2 put out their first three albums. And, you know, they were kind of a new
wave.
Yeah, they were awesome.
Produced by Steve Lillywhite.
Yeah, and those were greatness. And then all of a sudden, they announced, I was on the ship out in the Indian Ocean, and somebody had a magazine and had this little tiny article in the front that U2 hired Brian Eno to produce them. And at the time, I'm thinking, God, that's like strawberries and tuna fish. I just don't see it matching. And then they had a thing from U2 saying that they've been fans of Eno's work since day one. Well, how could you not be? And they said, they don't really plan on a big departure of their sound. And, of course, it was Unforgettable Fire, and it's still U2, but it was a different kind of sound.
It was different, yeah.
And then it went on from there, and he's continued to be involved with them. They still brought Steve Lillywhite in on every album, though.
Oh, they do? I didn't know that.
And Brian Eno didn't particularly care for it, but they said...
What, like to mix it or something?
Yeah, well, it said it was always turning out a little too clinical, and they couldn't solve some problems, so every one of those albums, Steve Lillywhite came back in and added something to it. And then I think it was Zaropa. I don't know if Brian Eno was really there. It was a guy called Flood, which I guess was involved.
Producer, yeah.
But I think he was involved with Eno, too, because I never knew that, but it seemed like all the albums since were those three, you know, Steve Lillywhite, Brian Eno, and Flood always worked with them. Anyway, props to Brian Eno. You're awesome in so many different aspects, and I'm glad my friend played you on this episode.
There you go. So, and now for something completely different, comic books.
Now, I want to, if you don't mind, I want to start one off, and I hate to repeat things, but Al talked in one episode about Madame Xanadu, Exodus Noir. You know, he got the trade. Well, I'm a huge Michael Kaluta fan, and Al just kept going on about this book, about the artwork, which is fantastic, and he liked the story as well.
It's an interesting, strange, deep story.
Well, that's enough for me. So, as I said, as soon as we finished the show, I went home, and I ordered it, got it. I'll tell you, I can't say enough about this thing. This is one of the best books I ever read, and the artwork is Michael Kaluta. It's strong all the way through. That story is just as strong as the artwork. Matt Wagner, you're a good artist. I like it better when you draw your own stories, but man, you can write the hell out of them, too.
Yeah, that was an interesting story.
Yeah. One of our listeners, Scott Connor, had mentioned that Matt Wagner's Sandman Mystery Theater are worth picking up as well.
Oh, the ones that Guy Davis did.
Oh, did he draw those?
I'm pretty sure he did.
I'm going to start looking those up, because I'll tell you, this one, Sandman shows up in this. You know,
you're right, he does show up. I forgot about that at the very end of it, yeah.
And Michael Kaluta drew him with a real gas mask, not the...
Yeah, he drew him like in the 40s.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it was kind of unnerving. There's a few things I want to talk about. It's one, the story. He's talking about the Spanish Inquisition, which is...
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. I don't have that clip, though, that we play all the time on Slow Robot.
Is that the Mel Brooks?
The Monty Python.
Oh, my... What a horrifying time it must have been.
Oh, yeah.
But it ties into this. It ties into New York in 1940. And one thing I wanted to point out in this...
You know what? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh,
yeah, Mel Brooks did do something in that movie, History of the World.
History of the World.
He did some stupid Inquisition song. You're right. Both of them.
Yeah, that's... I didn't know what the Spanish Inquisition was.
It's pretty bad.
I learned about it on that. So what's the Inquisition? And then you learn about... Yeah, that's an understatement. Pretty bad.
Yeah.
That was horrifying.
Yeah, anyway, back to the...
That was a funny scene. That was History of the World Part 1.
Part 1, yeah.
Part 2 was at the very end of it.
Oh, yeah. When the peasants are revolting. Yeah, they stand
yes.
on
eyes. But... When John Byrne did that comic book, Alpha Flight, in 1983, he started getting letters, because, you know, it was in Canada, is where the Alpha Flight was based, and our lovely northern cousins. And I guess he was getting a lot of mail for people complaining about that's not quite right, how he was drawing Canada. And in the letters page, he said, I guess our Canadian readers are thinking that they're expecting the National Geographic version of Canada instead of the New York version Marvel gives. Well, when I went to Manhattan, for, you know, one time, fantastic place. New York City is the greatest city in the world. It's just hard to fathom there's a place like that. But it's not really that big. I mean, you can get around in a day. You know, Manhattan. I mean, you could, you know. And when we were there, I just kept crossing over the same spots. But whenever you read a Marvel comic, you never. It's once in a while they'll draw a landmark. The rest of the time, it's just a generic city. You know,
I know what you mean. Yeah.
You never get any idea, center bearing, or anything. It's just generic drawings. And when I read Madame Xanadu, Exodus Noir, I wasn't around in the 40s, but when I read this, I feel like I am, and I recognize New York City, the little bit I've seen. Michael Kaluta, when he drew it, you feel like you're there. And the cars, the clothes, everything, it's a period piece, but it's not like...
Well, it's like what he did with the shadow, that's like always, that's part of his whole artistic whatever being, and so this resembles it a little bit. A little bit.
Well, yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it's not like you're looking at a period piece. It's like you're living it.
And that book goes from time to time. It goes from, like, the Middle Ages to the 40s till today, I guess, right?
Just the 40s. Middle Ages and the 40s. But the story was interesting. The way they drew it was interesting. And Michael Kaluta is the type of artist that he can show you. Every page he drew is extremely ornate with a lot of drawings in it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some times where he'll show something, but he can keep it vague. You know, let your mind work it out yourself. There were some neat things, like she shows up, nobody sees her, and she pulls a veil off, and he's got the background drawn like a veil coming off of her. Really clever. The charms that she uses and stuff. Madame Xanadu was basically a host for a DC comic book.
Doorway into Nightmare.
Yeah. Now, the story I found out at the beginning of this trade, they said Joe Orlando needed another host for a comic book, and he went to Michael Kaluta and said, we just need a host for this book, make it a woman. And so Michael Kaluta gave her, I remember buying some of those at the time, I wasn't really even interested in horror comics, but I love Michael Kaluta, and I thought she was, but I... But Fifth Element all over.
Oh boy!
But she, you know how sometimes you like horror comics, and then it went away, and then it came back. But she was a neat character, and in this one, they really fleshed her out without over-explaining anything.
Well, they turned it into something that completely different than I would ever expect.
Yeah, and that's it. You didn't expect it all the way to the end. Like I said, my friend showed me the book. We talked about it, and I got it. I'm telling you, just order it. If you have any passing interest in Michael Kaluta, Matt Wagner, or any kind of horror, Madame Xanadu, Exodus Noir is something to have. It's just a neat, great book.
I guess it was a series of Madame Xanadu in the late in the 2009 or before, and they had different arcs with different people, and that was one of their arcs. I'm sure there were other ones. I don't remember ever seeing the book. It might have been a time when I was going to a comic shop, I'm sure, but maybe like now, I wasn't going on a regular basis, so I wasn't seeing everything
I never noticed
that came out. But you never noticed it either.
Now, I saw, when I was putting the old post together, I saw a lot of the covers, and you're absolutely right. It was just one arc in a series of books. And from what I understand, the person did the introduction, they're all good, but Michael Kaluta shines like a diamond. And like I said, The way he places his characters together, the way he arranges his compositions, and all the ornate stuff he puts in, nobody else really does what he does.
No.
And when I saw him in Tampa in '88, somebody asked me to do a sketch, and I think he was drawing the shadow. But I was really surprised when he started drawing. He basically had the shadow on an old car, on the passenger side. And half of his body is sticking out of the car, like his foot's on them. The old cars had that running step along it.
Mm-hmm.
He's stepping out, holding the gun. He's looking out, his shoulder's still in the car. But he was drawing it. It wasn't straight. It was at an angle. He tends to do that. And I just thought, I never would have put a drawing in that. I wouldn't have started off that way.
Right.
And I remember the guy that hired him, him and his friend to look, and they're all like, wow, look what he's doing. And I was really surprised at his approach. And I stood there pestering the whole time, talking to him, and he was just drawing. And finally, at one point, he drew quite a while, and he said, he just stopped, and he said, you know, I'm only getting $20 for this. And then he said, well, this is an 88, you know. And he just stopped.
Those were the days, yeah. Huh?
But he stopped and looked at me and said, this is done. But he wasn't saying it to me. He was saying it to himself. And that's one of the things. Well, and yeah, it was. He was greatness. But, you know, I look in this Madame Xanadu and everything else Michael Kaluta done. If you look at it, he puts everything into everything he does, which is what makes him greatness. But, a lot of times when some artists will do that, it's like you get lost. Yeah, but when he does it, it just adds to it. You know, even though there's a lot to it, the story never gets lost. You know, the graphics are always in service of the narrative. You know, anyway, I can't say enough about it. As a matter of fact, if I had money, everybody that would write into this show, I would send them a copy, man, as that'd do. But I'm not rich, so I'm not going to. But you can find it on your own.
You can find it on Amazon.
Or any seller. And I can't recommend it enough.
All right. That's a 4-star, 5-star recommendation.
Yeah, that's that right there. Story and art. It, you know, when Dallas had the old one, this one, I would give a 10 for both of them.
All right. Next.
Okay, well, this one I want to start off with an apology. On the last episode at the very end, I had about 6 books I pulled out of a dollar box. And I was saving them for when Dallas was on the show. And it had been so long since we'd done the show that I'd forgotten about the books. And I'm very sorry. And I was talking about, I can't remember the name of that book I was talking about, but I was wrong. I wasn't describing that book. I was describing Chrononauts.
Oh, okay.
And Al and I just went to a comic store in Tampa. I bought the first issue of Wilson's, and I liked it. Well, I went and found the other 3 issues at this store in Tampa that we found by accident, which was pretty good, called Nerd Out Comics. And I'll have a link on the blog if you'd like to check them out. But anyway, I got the other 4 issues, and this is great fun. It was Mark Miller. It's one of his books. And who's the artist?
Sean Murphy.
Yeah, no, when we were there, Al bought a couple of the books. And he said you did like the artist.
Yeah, I did.
I did, too. I'm not familiar.
Sean Gordon Murphy.
How do you know him?
From online. I've seen some of his work online. He's done other books. I just don't know which ones they are, but I did see... You know what? You know, I'll tell you exactly how I know, because I'm not really... Somehow or another, I get Twitter emails, like, who's on Twitter? I get comic book people.
Yeah.
And he was one of them. And I go, I've seen that art before. And it was, and that's how I know him.
Oh, okay. But the whole thing in this is time travel. Chrononauts. And basically, I described it before... it's like a 1970s buddy TV show. Like, it always reminds me of Starsky and Hutch or Chips. You know, you got 2 partners that are good friends. And this one, they both come across as kind of like football players to me, but they're both professors. And but they build a time machine, which looks like the Stargate in that movie Stargate. It's a big arc. But they have suits. In the first issue, the main professor, he's in an archaeology thing in some, you know, like an ancient civilization where everybody outside is kind of peasants living out in the desert. And they find this big cave, and inside the cave it's got, you know, like F-14 aircraft. It's got, you know, motor cars. And I mean, it's ancient. But it's this giant warehouse full of everything. You know, motorcycles, tanks. And he looks delighted, like he knows something. Well, then it shows him back in, I don't know where they're based out of. But he hires this other guy, and they become partners. They build this time machine. They're both like a couple of cowboys, and that's on the news. And the main professor has an ex-wife who's married to somebody else. And he alludes to the fact that his father died of cancer. And she was mad because he never saw him. Well, it's because he was so engrossed in his work. He wasn't a good husband. He wasn't a good son. And he basically had no one. Well, then he goes back in time, and he's supposed to come back, and he doesn't. So his partner ends up putting on a suit and going back. And his partner finds him, and they're like some ancient Persian type, you know, race. But they have tanks and, you know, all armaments, helicopters and stuff. Come to find that he set himself up as a king, and he's using the suit to go through different timelines and taking what he needs. I wasn't expecting that. And the whole series is just one after another, these two guys doing it. But it's like, again, it's like some crazy buddy movie. And they're pulling stunts all over the place. If you read a Ray Bradbury, he did a time travel story where people would go back in time and shoot dinosaurs.
Oh, EC did an adaptation, Sound of Thunder or something like that?
Well, this one, I bought it. It was a book called Dinosaurs. It had three short stories that he did. One was about a dinosaur that fell in love with a lighthouse, which I think is what?
That's the Ray Harryhausen movie.
Yeah. But it was originally a short story, and it was about a creature that fell in love with a lighthouse.
That's right, yeah.
And that was in the book. The reason I bought it, one, I like Ray Bradbury. William Stout did the cover, but the reason I bought it is because Mobius did some illustrations in it, and so, you know, I got it. But the stories were fun, but one of them, and I think William Stout did the illustrations, which are great.
Is this a hardcover or a paperback?
It's a paperback. I bought it at the Navy Exchange when I first went to ship.
Oh, nice.
So part of it was just trying to illuminate my impending loneliness of first going on the ship, you know, boredom and loneliness. But the time travel story was about this organization, a company that would bring you back with an elephant gun to kill a dinosaur. But they had a path you're supposed to cross, and you weren't supposed to step off that path. And they kept stressing if you even crushed a blade of grass or killed an insect that you weren't supposed to, you'll completely change the whole timeline. And they said the dinosaurs you kill are basically already found and they were getting ready to die for whatever reason anyway. So you just shoot them right before they were actually supposed to die. Still dangerous and stuff. Well, in that story, the protagonist goes back in time. And he messes up. He slips and falls. I don't think he kills the dinosaur. He falls off the path. He crushes a flower. I think there was a bug on it. They freak. They pull him up, and they're dressing him down. He's falling apart. And it says, you messed everything up. And they go back in the future, and I think all the people are lizard people.
Okay.
It completely changed the timeline.
So I'm
thinking that on this book, and on this one, they were saying if you do anything in the past, you can change it. But man, I'll tell you, these two guys completely go over the top and change everything. But I don't see any difference in the present tense. And at one point, one of the characters says, because they can monitor everything, and then they say, well, if they make a change to the timeline, are we going to know? I says, no, it'll change without us noticing. But nothing really changed. Of course, you know, then I'm not going to tell you about the ending. I found it satisfying, but they're not following the timeline as strictly as Ray Bradbury did. And I like Mark Millar. I found in the last few things I read by him, but I'd still choose Ray Bradbury over him.
Well, I'm telling you, it seems like it's a story that EC did in one of their science fiction books called The Sound of Thunder. I'll double check it, but I'm interested in that paperback. That sounds pretty cool. I mean, I never heard of it before.
I'll dig it up.
In the 80s? Or?
Yeah, about in 83.
Because I always like paperbacks with illustrations. Like, remember in the old days, they had those DAW DAW paperbacks, and I know one of them had, like, Kaluta and Roy Krenkel illustrations in there. I remember getting that a long time ago, and I'm always into that.
This one, it was almost magazine size. You know,
it wasn't a little paperback. It wasn't a strict paperback, okay.
But I saw it at the Navy Exchange and got it, and then later on the ship, everybody had Heavy Metal and National Lampoon. And
the ship
House
carried those magazines?
Yeah. Along with Penthouse and Playboy.
Those guys, yeah.
So you always saw those four magazines around. And in Heavy Metal, they had a write-up on that book, Dinosaurs, by Ray Bradbury, and it just went on and on about nobody knows dinosaurs like Ray Bradbury. True, you know.
Okay.
And I thought, yeah, it's a good book. I do have it. I'll just have to dig it out somewhere. I don't know where it is. But
hey, on your pile of books, I want to talk specifically about Dominic Fortune. Okay, and the reason why is because I didn't read the whole thing, but we both you gave me a link to a Howard Chaykin interview this week.
Yeah.
I don't know what to make of him. You know, he's like, obviously he's a very opinionated guy or whatever. And this is the stuff Dominic Forge. This was actually inked by Austin, which is kind of interesting.
Well, if you read the credits on this, what Al's talk about is a Marvel premiere number 56 featuring Dominic Fortune. And we were at Yancey Street going through the dollar boxes, of course. And Al said, do you have this? This is good. Well, I love Howard Chaykin. I liked old Howard Chaykin. I love new Howard Chaykin. I just think he's greatness. He's absolutely one of my favorites. And in this one, it says a plot was by Lynn Wein and Howard Chaykin. Script is by Dave Nicolini. Layouts, Howard Chaykin. Finished art by Terry Austin. And I don't particularly like it when Howard Chaykin does layouts and is finished by somebody else. This one
you like.
I do like. I love Terry Austin, and I never would have thought that Howard Chaykin and Terry Austin would have made a good team. But they do. It's got the looseness that Howard Chaykin puts in some of his work. But Terry Austin finished it in quite well. It was a good book. I liked the story. I really enjoyed myself in this.
I really miss the days, and I'm sure they're still going on today, where like there was a lot of inking and penciling going on, because it was almost like jamming.
Yeah.
It was almost like, Clapton jamming with Beck, or you know, musical things or whatever. You never knew what to expect. And every once in a while, you'd think that two guys collaborating would be like a mess, and sometimes it was a mess. But
yeah, most
then
of the time.
Sometimes, I don't know, but sometimes. But then all of a sudden you get this one that you didn't expect, and you're like, whoa, that's pretty amazing. I really do miss the days when there was a lot of that going on. Like I said, I'm sure there still is some inking going on by people, but the guys that have distinctive styles, I don't even care. You know, Terry Austin, distinctive style. You know, Rubenstein and McLeod and Tom Palmer and all those guys. I really do like Vince Coletta's work. So, because for what it's worth, it was different from other people. I don't know. It was like a time when it was like, you're right. Sometimes it was disappointing, but man, sometimes it was like wild. You know?
Yeah, I agree. And one, I never would have thought I would. I like Klaus Janson.
I do. Klaus Janson, yeah.
But definitely. I never would have thought I would have liked Klaus Janson and George Perez together.
That was nice.
It was absolutely
nice.
That
was Manwolf, right? Or one of those?
I think it was Richard Valamonte.
Okay.
It was the Logan's Run miniseries.
Oh, those are great, yeah.
And those are great. Now, and I do like it, but when Gil Kane drew one of the What If books Marvel put out, it was where What If the Avengers Broke Up.
I liked that one, too. You didn't like it?
Well, I liked it, but I didn't care for Janson's inking over Gil Kane at first because I said he's too sloppy. But I grew to just think it's the greatest. But I've seen Klaus Janson ink some other people. Again, he inked George Perez and something else, I think.
Yeah,
but
escapes me now.
He has a looseness to it, but with him and Frank Miller, I thought that was second to none.
Yeah, that was a great team up. Yeah,
but
yeah.
Terry Austin is one of those. He's got a unique, tight style.
He's got that, like, it looks like he's using a markers as opposed to, pen and ink. But he is using...
Using repeated graphs and pens. He's got a great control. I don't think he's really much of a brush artist. I may be wrong,
but
he was always very tight and very technical. On John Byrne, I thought that was just a symbiosis. It worked together. I don't think you were all that crazy about it.
I liked it, but I wasn't like, it didn't blow my,
it wasn't quite in your, in your wheelhouse.
Austin did a great job inking Miller, too, on that one, Elektra. What if Elektra hadn't died?
He inked the last issue Miller did of Daredevil, the one where they're playing Russian roulette.
Yeah.
And Terry Austin, he inked basically everybody, and the thing
and now
was...
he's inking Archie's.
Yeah, Ancient Ink and Sonic
Pretty
the Hedgehog,
sure, yeah.
I think. But the thing about Terry Austin, I remember my friend Britt had mentioned it in the Frank Miller book, says Terry Austin proved he could ink anybody and make them look good. And the thing was, he has a really strong style, but it remains. He always has that strong, tight style. But he's not covering up the other artist. You know, sometimes...
No, you could see the other artist, yeah.
Some really good inkers have a real heavy footprint. Joe Sennett. And when I say this, I love Joe Sennett.
Yep, he is.
Extremely heavy footprint.
Yep, he sure is.
Dick Giordano is one of my favorite inkers, and I think he was also really good at showing off the other artists, but again, to me, he still kind of had a... You could see a lot of Dick Giordano in everything he inked. And I think Terry Austin started out with Dick Giordano as an assistant.
I think a lot of these guys did.
But Terry Austin was one of those as well. When you see it immediately, you know it's Terry Austin. But, I mean, this one, I could still see Howard Chaykin. And,
oh, yeah.
And I don't normally like it when a whole lot of different people... I mean, like I said, Lynn Wein and Howard Chaykin came up with the plot. Howard Chaykin broke it down or laid it out. David Michelinie, you know, wrote it, I guess, added all the dialogue, and then Terry Austin finished it. A lot of times I say that, I hear train wreck, but in this case, it's one of those where everything just fell into place. And thanks for pointing it out, I really enjoyed this book.
I thought you had it. I was one of those where it was like, oh, let me just throw it at him, see if he doesn't have it, and you didn't, right?
Yeah, well, I think I got scared when I tackled him and grabbed it out of his hand.
Yeah, especially in the store in front of all the people. I mean, you know, there's cameras there. I could have, you know, but I decided not to because I'm a nice guy and all that. I'm not litigious at all or anything, so... But yeah, I figured you had it, but I figured I'll just give it a shot. I bought it back in the 70s.
Well, what were you gonna say about Howard Chaykin?
He had some weird things to say. You know, it was like I said, I didn't read the whole thing. I read about like three quarters maybe, but it was like it almost seemed like he wasn't really into Kirby. You know, he said like his favorite artist was like Gil Kane and. He was like, you know, if it wouldn't have been for Gil Kane, everybody would have been drawing everything like Kirby. So things like that.
Yeah,
that
well, no.
Like,
I
don't know.
Howard Chaykin's a person who has an extremely strong personality.
Opinionated, I
Well, yeah, but, I mean, strong. He's... I love Howard Chaykin, and when I met him, I just found him nothing but terrific. He was very congenial, very, very kind to... You know, we were all college students at the time. I'll never forget that.
Yeah, that's because you didn't say the wrong thing.
But
in his opinion,
when I read about him, I mean, like I said, strong opinion. But sometimes when you hear him, if you're not around him, it sounds more biting than it is. And my buddy Britt posted on his Facebook page, and I found it, I read it, I enjoyed it, I passed it on to you. Al and I differ. We both like Howard Chaykin's early work, but you prefer the earlier work to what he turned into.
Yeah, right before American Flag.
Now, saying that, I completely agree with everything Al says on that. He's right. But nevertheless, I love the later work and what he turned into for all the reasons Al does not. I mean, that's just how the world works.
Mm-hmm.
I love Howard. American Flag to me is, especially the first 12 issues, is one of the greatest comic books ever done, in my opinion.
See, he even said that in the interview, and I wholeheartedly disagree on that.
Now, he also brings up in that people don't know how American Flag, but they always remember him as the guy that messed up Star Wars.
The guy that messed up Star Wars.
Now, let me tell you,
that was kind of funny, yeah.
When he says that, you can see me standing up in the front row throwing tomatoes at him, because when I was so excited about that comic, and I bought one issue, and I was so pissed off. I remember my brother bought one of those giant $1.50 oversized
versions.
Well, Dallas has both of them. To him, those are prized possessions. And if you talk to Dallas, you see the little boy inside everybody just come out all starry-eyed. And I mean, and it's great, great love. You can see Dallas's heart expand and envelope the whole thing. When I see it, I just get bitter. I just want to throw rocks at Howard Chaykin. I mean, I was so pissed at that. And then when I was reading, and I think Starlog magazine, they were talking about it, and they said that George Lucas handpicked Howard Chaykin to do the project.
I know.
Why? Why? And the whole time I kept thinking George Perez should have been the artist to draw that. Of course, you know, at the time, George Perez should have drawn everything. But I thought, why would you hire this guy to do that? It didn't look anything like Star Wars. And Howard Chaykin brought that up several times in the meeting. He says, I wish... And I've read him say this. He says he said it, and every time he's ever interviewed, he brings it up. he wished he would have put more into it if he would have known what he just thought Star Wars was some passing space movie that nobody.
That's it. It was just another B movie, another drive-in B movie for the summer, and I was just like, yeah, it's another assignment. I gotta move on.
Yeah, no. I want to say this: Howard Chaykin is a strict professional, and a lot of the work he does is just breathtaking work. But I still remember some books, like there was an issue of Micronauts he did that Vince Coletti inked.
Oh, well, yeah.
And I know, but I just, there were times where you pick up a Howard Chaykin book and you think, what the fuck, you know?
As much as I like Vince Coletti's work, I don't think you could give him loose pencils, because he would just turn it into like a quick Vince Coletti-ish job. You had to give him tight pencils for him to do his best work.
Yeah, but I mean, his best work to me most of the time was always lacking. You know,
not Tales to Astonish.
Some of the work was fantastic, and his Tales of Asgard.
Definitely like Tales of Asgard.
Tales of Asgard, I think, was his best work.
He was definitely like hit or miss.
Oh yeah, and most of the time he was miss. He just put in little effort to everything. And of course, I say that Howard Chaykin, I guess, was doing breakdowns.
He wasn't putting much effort into it, too. But, so it's like a little effort on both
guys. I'm going to guess that in those cases that the inker got paid more as a finisher.
I don't know.
But I don't know. Like I said, his Cody Starbuck work is...
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, and those My Star is My Destiny, those Byron Priest books he did.
Which he said he didn't get much money off of.
But one thing he said on that was... the only person that made any money off Byron Priest was projects was Byron Priest. One thing, and I don't know too much about Byron Priest, but I got some of his books. I picked them up. He was, to me, a little bit I know, an extremely interesting person. Because when he passed away...
Byron Priest passed away?
Yeah, a while back.
Oh.
Yeah, I found out that... If you listen to the show, you know that I'm a huge Valerian fan, as I said at the beginning of this episode. Well, Dargold USA put out four of the volumes back in the early 80s. Later on, in I guess the early 90s, NBM got the license. They put out those same four books, and they were planning on putting out more. And the same thing, they closed shop, and we never got anything else. Well, I was always aggravated about it. Well, Byron Priest put out three of the books, and they were the three books going back to The Fifth Element. When Luc Besson started The Fifth Element, the Bruce Willis character was supposed to work in a rocket ship manufacturing yard. And then his financing was coming apart because they didn't feel a French guy could do a really good science fiction movie for an American audience. So he went to make money, and he did The Professional. In France, it was called Leon, which was a really good movie. And when that movie came out, it did so well that he got his backers back. See, if you do a movie like that, it's a big international success, then you got us. Well, in between that time, J.C. Mazieres went back to doing Valerian. And him and Pierre Christian did a series where Valerian and Loreline are on this planet, and they get this crazy taxi driver. Well, Luc Besson fell in love with the taxi, and so he changed, I forgot his name all of a sudden. okay. Bruce Willis. He changed Bruce Willis from being a spaceship factory worker to a taxi driver because he fell in love with that taxi. Anyway, Byron Priest took those three issues, or those three volumes of Valerian, and put them in a smaller volume of all three together. I found out about it. It was already out of print. I bought it, on an online seller. It was good. The problem is they shrunk the pages down smaller than it should have been. But I was reading about Byron Priest. When he passed away, there was a lot of projects going on. And his wife tried to run the company with somebody else to keep those projects going. And one thing she said was that I guess they always worked on a shoestring budget. And she said, we didn't have Byron Priest's unique mind to keep these projects going because they were always underfunded. It was always, from the skin of their teeth that they got anything out. And he said, when Byron was gone, so that was it. He said, they tried to do it and it just fell apart. So when Howard Chaykin said that, I believe it. But I don't think it was a malicious thing. I think it was just... the reason Howard Chaykin did American Flag for First Comics is because he lost his shirt over the Byron Priest projects, and they didn't make the kind of money they were supposed to. And what the deal was at first was he could do what he wanted, and American Flag was the flagship of First Comics. It wasn't their first book, but it was the one that pulled them out. And he had, I don't know, I think 6 years you're supposed to do it, and it basically got him out of bankruptcy and everything else. And it was fantastic work. Towards the end, he started using a lot more assistants, and then I guess First replaced him with another artist, and
Mike Vosburgh or somebody like that.
I love Mike Vosburgh, but it wasn't the best work. You know, I know Wendy Penny that did ElfQuest was complaining. I loved it when she did ElfQuest, but later her and her husband were thinking they could get other artists to come in and expand the world. What they were thinking of was Marvel Comics. Even though Jack Kirby was a house style, and him and Steve Ditko and Stan Lee did all the stuff, other people could come in and do their take on it, and that's what they were looking at for ElfQuest, and I think that's what they're looking at for American Flag. But it just didn't work.
Well, because everybody had to do it in his style.
Yeah.
And with the Ken Brusenac inking, I mean, lettering, and
which was fantastic.
It was fantastic, but the book was, it was, let's put it this way, it was style over substance in a lot of ways. And that's what, to me, Howard Chaykin is mostly, just a really strong style. And I'm not saying never substance, but it's the style overpowers anything else, which is fine, you know, we can say that for a lot of people or whatever, but with that book, it was like when everybody took it over, like you said, they had to imitate Howard Chaykin. They couldn't come in and do it in their own style, so that's what the problem was.
Well, they failed miserably. I remember James Sherman did one issue.
And I liked James Sherman's art.
Yeah, I didn't like it on that one. Did you see the American Flag issue?
No, I didn't see it.
Anyway.
I think even Tom Sutton did one. I'm pretty sure Vosburgh did some of them.
I know they had a Howard Chaykin, it was a later issue of American Flag, and Howard Chaykin came back, but most of the work was Mike Vosburgh. I think Howard Chaykin kind of...
Didn't Joe Staton do some of them, too?
I wasn't buying them anymore by that time.
Okay.
But, I don't know. Again, American Flag, especially the first 12 issues, to me, are staggering. And it did have a style, it had a graphic style, and... That's one of those issues where, you know, Al mentioned Ken Brusenac was the letterer. It went far beyond that. You got to remember, this is early 80s technology, and he was using press type lettering. They were getting typesetting, but it wasn't the actual lettering of the comic book. It was all the graphics they put over it. And he was on, Ken Brusenac was on Sidebar on that podcast, and he was talking that he was having to go to type houses and get typesetting set up. And Howard Chaykin said, we need this, do this, do this. So he would set it all up, and then he'd have to give Howard Chaykin the bill. Sometimes those bills were astronomical. Typesetting was expensive. And he said Howard Chaykin every once in a while was stunned at how much the bill was, and Brusenac was kind of embarrassed to give it to him, but Howard said, well, you know, it's what it is. But, you know, now this is stuff that you can do by yourself on a computer, no issue with, you know, Illustrator or any of these, you know, InDesign. But at the time, I remember reading that, I'm thinking, how in the world is he affording this? Unless he's typesetting it himself. But it was unique. And to me, it said a lot. They were bringing up subliminal messages. People were living in shopping malls. He was bringing up the whole thing about... East and West political philosophies. They were bringing up holographic images. It was all kinds of stuff he was putting into these books. The guy at the comic store was telling me he was excited because they kept talking about these designer drugs that people were on in the book. It was violent, had a lot of sex, you know, a lot of drugs, which surprised me. But it was for an older audience. It wasn't an all-ages book, and I don't think any kids would even be interested in American Flag. But nevertheless, to me, it was something. And even some of the, I keep saying the 12 issues, but later issues were still good, but it was starting to do a backslide. But anyway, I love Howard Chaykin. I still buy the books he does. I like Satellite Sam. I liked, as we talk about, when he did that Shadow series for some other company, the Midnight in Moscow.
Yep.
Avengers 1959. I can't get enough of Howard Chaykin. Anyway, we'll post this this interview with him, I thought it was terrific. And he does have heart. He loves comic books. And one thing he was talking about, he was Gil Kane's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And he always brings it up. He says, I'm Gil, and a lot of other people helped him, and that's why he's always willing to help other people.
That's good.
And like I said, when I met him, he was nothing but terrific, even though I wouldn't want to be on his bad side.
Or say the wrong thing.
Well, that's easy to do.
Like you mentioned Will Eisner.
Well, you've
told that story before.
Yeah, that with Will Eisner, but at the same time, I don't know. You know, sometimes certain people just should get together, and I think there's an art to... I think there's an art sometimes if somebody maybe says something a little offensive, just to kind of let it go a little bit. How many times have you been in your life where somebody said the wrong, and even myself, maybe sometimes I've said something that you're thinking, just shut up. But, you know, you don't fly off the handle and try to fight somebody.
Especially now it's not like in public or, you know, with people, with your audience.
Yeah.
If it's a good friend, you might go like, hey, man, you know, keep
Yeah, but
it,
yeah. but that's it. You know, I mean, and when I say this, the whole planet is full of human beings. We're not perfect.
Not
life
all
isn't
the
perfect.
Planet. There's some people from outer space.
Well, I'm not talking about outer space people.
I'm talking about the Men in Black.
But I love those movies. Anyway, here we go again.
No, like we're not going to talk about those movies.
As far as that, I mean, like I said, just every once in a while, is it going to kill you just to kind of let it slip? I'm not talking about somebody trying to do physical harm or destroy somebody, but sometimes in my life, every time I've ever gotten in trouble is because I let my ego get the best of me.
Yeah.
And sometimes somebody may say something or do something you don't particularly agree with or like, but I mean, honestly, what is it? I mean, I look back on some of these, you know, just let it go, dude.
Yeah,
you
know? I know.
Anyway, but...
Hey, listen, man, we're getting, like, really late, so we'll talk about that book.
Okay, we got time? Oh, next time? All right.
Let's talk about it next time. We're already past the hour mark on this.
Oh, jeez, listen, man, we only talked about my books.
I know, and I couldn't talk about my one book, but we'll do it next time, though.
All right, dude. I'm sorry, dude.
That's okay, I'll live.
Anyway,
you won't hurt my feelings. Just don't mention Will Eisner, okay?
I love Will Eisner.
Me too.
Anyway, anything else you want to
No,
say?
That's it. That's it, man. This is show, what,
151? 151.
Wow, it's been a long, what a long, strange trip it's been.
Doesn't seem like it's been
Doesn't
long.
Seem like but it's been 4 years.
Oh, it's
years
fun, you know, getting
man.
With your friends, talk about comics.
No doubt about it. Yeah, again, putting it on the internet as opposed to just all the conversation that we have in cars and bars and...
Yeah.
Fast food restaurants and stuff like that.
And speaking of which, thank you very much for listening to us. I appreciate it. And thank you very much for the iTunes reviews. If anybody listens to the show and you got a minute, please feel free to rate us in iTunes or leave us a review. It just takes a minute. It really helps us out in the ratings. You can also find us on Stitcher Radio. And I think that's about it.
That's all, folks.
Yeah. So
I
guess...
In the meantime...
Read
more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops.